This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon.com and by University of California Press, which publishes loads of titles of interest to Dig listeners like you. One that you might find interesting is Race and America's Long War by Nikhil Pal Singh. Donald Trump's election produced shock and disbelief for liberals, progressive, and leftists globally. Yet most of the immediate analysis neglects longer-term accounting of how the United States arrived here. Race and America's Long War examines the relationship between war, politics, police power, and the changing contours of race and racism in the contemporary United States. Singh argues that the United States' pursuit of war since the September 11th terrorist attacks has reanimated a longer history of imperial statecraft that segregated and eliminated enemies both within and overseas. America's territorial expansion and Indian removals, settler in-migration and nativist restriction, and African slavery and its afterlives were formative social and political processes that drove the rise of the United States as a capitalist world power long before the onset of globalization. Spanning the course of U.S. history, these crucial essays show how the return of racism and war as seemingly permanent features of American public and political life is at the heart of our present crisis and collective disorientation. Race and America's Long War by Nikhil Pal Singh, out now from University of California Press. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is a second week in a row where The Diglett has two separate guests. A lot is happening. I had two interviews scheduled, and I polled listeners, and listeners overwhelmingly told me to post the two interviews separately if they were on two different topics. So here we go. The massacre in Las Vegas has once again put the long simmering debate over gun control back on boil. The shooter had 23 firearms in his hotel room, including, according to the Washington Post, at least a dozen semi-automatic rifles legally modified to fire like automatic weapons. The debate follows a well-worn and familiar path. Liberals cry out for more gun control, and members of the NRA-tethered Republican Party decry the politicization of tragedy, as if the question of how someone gets their hands on a dozen essentially automatic rifles isn't inherently a political one. But what this debate obscures is that we already have a form of gun control in the United States. The problem is that it's a form of gun control that does little to nothing to keep us safe, and that mostly results in locking up huge numbers of poor black men. This, to be clear, is not an argument against gun control. I'm not a fan at all of either the case made by the NRA on the right or the case made by some on the radical left that says we need firearms to resist the government. Rather, my point is that we currently have a two-tiered right to bear arms in this country that has led the right to bear any and every arm being sacrosanct for white Americans while being relentlessly criminalized for many black Americans. I firmly believe that we must disarm all of American society, including, ultimately, the police. What the current setup does is it permits the mass production and distribution of guns into a segregated two-tier system of gun rights. The result is that we have horrible shootings, whether on the south side of Chicago or from the broken window of a Las Vegas hotel, alongside mass incarceration of black men for carrying guns, the mere possession of guns. In short, our gun control status quo is the worst setup imaginable. Reporters, unfortunately, almost never talk about this, and I find it incredibly frustrating, as you can probably tell. For many journalists, it's always a question of there being just two positions, on guns or really on anything, one a liberal position and the other a conservative position. As a result, a real left position is often rendered invisible. That's why so many political reporters, for example, had such a hard time making sense of Bernie Sanders initially. When it comes to guns, I think the left should say this. We want a society without readily available weapons of war on the streets and a society without mass incarceration. It seems reasonable enough to me. Not that it'll be easy to make this happen, either of them, but it seems like a reasonable enough vision and statement of principles to me. Anyhow, my guest for this episode is Ben Levin, a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes about criminal law and procedure. Before entering academia, he practiced civil rights law, focusing on police and prosecutorial misconduct, and served as a law clerk to two federal judges. More to the point, his 2016 article, Guns and Drugs, in the Fordham Law Review, really helped shape my thinking on guns and mass incarceration. Ben Levin, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
I'm really glad to have you on to talk about gun control because it was your law review article that really helped me think through the relationship between gun control and mass incarceration. And I'm hoping that we can thread a needle here to mix metaphors, also puncture some unfortunate arguments that characterize the current debate. So let's start with this. We do have forms of gun control in this country, contrary to popular belief, but they're forms of gun control that mostly result in sending poor black men to prison in large numbers. Explain how that is.
Sure. So it's a dynamic that plays out in the realm of gun control, but it's a dynamic that plays out, unfortunately, pretty broadly in our legal system, which is that often in a world of partisan gridlock or in a world where different sides may have really different views, there often will be some kind of common ground. And unfortunately, what we've seen in the second half of the 20th century and in the dawn of the 21st century is that common ground is all too often criminal law. So a number of legal scholars have kind of waded into this area, have sort of theorized why that is in terms of kind of what sorts of risks politicians can take. A lot of writing and a lot of thought has gone into what happened, say, to the Democratic Party in the wake of the Dukakis campaign and the Willie Horton ad, and this idea that then with the Clinton administration, there was kind of a Democratic turn to tough on crime. So what we've seen is a number of areas where I think there is compromise, and that compromise looks like criminal law. You know, taking the gun example specifically, what we've seen is this really interesting space where folks on the left, but gun control advocates generally are really concerned with, broadly speaking, getting guns off the street. Right? They don't want there to be as many guns that are there. They're concerned about gun violence, and they're generally not enthusiastic about the idea that that people have guns. For real gun rights advocates, for the NRA, for organizations like that, it's actually very helpful for them to make it clear that they really care about what they call law-abiding gun owners rather than kind of lawless gun owners. But it's not good. It's not good for business. I guess there are debates about this, but it sends a bad message to the public when there's a great deal of gun violence. And for the NRA in particular, in a number of situations, the NRA has actually come out and backed really harsh criminal regulatory mechanisms. So what you have is this strange point of compromise where the NRA, and again, a range of gun rights groups, particularly sort of Republican politicians who might have closer ties with the NRA, are very, very critical and will fight very hard against regulatory mechanisms aimed at manufacturers, aimed at sellers, aimed at kind of larger interests, or that appear to be aimed at, again, kind of this idea of the law-abiding gun owner, the person who might be an NRA member, who might own a large number of guns. But they really have no particular stake in protecting, let's say, the person who actually doesn't own a gun lawfully, maybe the person who has a criminal record and is in possession of a gun, right? So that person doesn't fall within the protection of those interest groups, kind of, again, generally speaking, on the right. And then from the left, to the extent there are folks who really are sort of absolutists in the sense that they just don't want guns out there. And again, even folks who are less absolutist, it's a pretty easy sell to say, here is this person who as a society we have identified as risky. Why should that person have a gun? End result is compromise on criminal law.
So before we delve any deeper, if you could just lay out what this particular statutes are that end up criminalizing gun possession in a way that fuels mass incarceration, and what the result of those statutes being policed and prosecuted are.
There are a range of these statutes, both state and federal, and actually some at the municipal level. So there are a bunch of different kinds of regulatory statutes involving guns. The one that I wrote about in the article that you mentioned, generally speaking, are statutes that regulate possession rather than use, right? So there are definitely plenty of statutes on the books that say, you can't fire a gun, across the street, or you can't fire a gun at another person, or things like that. But what I was particularly interested in and remain particularly interested in are these statutes that deal with possession, because it's often something that comes up. Again, it's coming up now. It comes up, in what's unfortunately all too often the wake of serious instances of gun violence. So these statutes will in some way regulate who can possess a gun, what type of gun they can possess, or where they can possess a gun. So there are a number of these statutes that I've written critically about, and some other folks have, that courts have been ambivalent about, that are often referred to as felon in possession or as felon in possession statutes, or maybe criminal in possession statutes. And the idea is that you'll have a statute that forbids someone with a criminal record, and I want to just kind of put an asterisk there for a second, but someone with a criminal record from possessing a gun. So if that person at some point either purchases a gun unlawfully, winds up, borrowing a gun from someone, or had owned a gun before and didn't turn it over, and she has, it turns out, a criminal record, she'll then be in violation of the criminal code, which means that, maybe if she's stopped and her car is searched by a police officer, it turns out there's a gun, for some reason, once she comes across law enforcement's radar, she's going to be facing usually very, very harsh punishments, often mandatory minimum penalties, which is, again, another reason why I think a lot of these gun statutes should be concerning, is that they raise the same specter that we see so heavily criticized in the context of the war on drugs, of very harsh penalties, of mandatory minimum penalties that don't allow for kind of for discretion or downward departure. So I mentioned that sort of asterisk in terms of the criminal record piece. What is really interesting about these statutes is, there often isn't actually any specification as to sort of what the criminal record could be for, right? So someone could have been convicted of a range of different crimes very long ago, whatever the case may be. That criminal record still will render them unable to possess a gun lawfully, and they'll be treated harshly as a result. So that's, one kind of general class. There also are restrictions on where someone can possess a gun. So think of kind of the paradigmatic example as the jurisdictions in which there might be some regulation on having a gun on school grounds or near a school. So statutes like this, again, kind of raise a different set of questions, have different dynamics, and play out differently in different places. So there are some jurisdictions actually where And this is true in terms of drugs as well as guns, where because of how, for example, a city is planned or designed or has just come to be, it may be that very little of the city will actually not be a school zone. So that if it turns out that the police officer stops someone, on a street in most places, they will actually be susceptible to that punishment. So that would be kind of a, let's say, like a location of possession. And then the third general kind of class of gun laws that we have regulates the type of weapon. Now, kind of as between those first two, I think the primary maybe is a little more concerning. The third class is as to weapon type. So that would be kind of the idea that, it's unlawful to possess a firearm that contains that will accommodate, for example, a clip that has more than nine shells or something along those lines. I think, again, one of that intuitively to many folks might make sense, because a practical matter raises some really interesting questions, because often what actually is defined as, for example, a high capacity firearm is a pretty common consumer item, that the threshold is actually lower statutorily than it is in the consumer world.
The case that you make in your article from last year, Guns and Drugs, and that you started to lay out there, is that a lot of the same problems that critics point out about the war on drugs map pretty well on to the war on guns, but the debate is very different. In fact, the way the entire debate is structured as just kind of NRA libertarian right versus liberal pro-gun control really seems to obscure how the policing and prosecution of guns has created this sort of two-tiered right to bear arms in this country, and as a result become really one of the key components, among many, of the carceral state.
Yeah, so I think one thing that's interesting and that actually concerns me is, I think in some ways there's a dangerous preoccupation with the Second Amendment in these conversations, right? So it makes sense that maybe from a gun rights perspective or an anti-gun control perspective, the Second Amendment and the language of the Second Amendment are very important and very helpful. And certainly given what the Supreme Court did in Heller and in McDonald, the two big cases where the court defined the Second Amendment as guaranteeing an individual right to bear arms, those are, that becomes very important to folks who care deeply about their right to have guns. I think from a gun control perspective, and for liberals, for folks on the left, for folks on the right who may be kind of more skeptical to some of those positions, I think one of the problems is that the concern or the frame is in terms of simply a right to bear arms or a lack of such a right to bear arms, right? So it's all about the Second Amendment. And so for folks who either don't want guns, who don't think other people should have guns, it's not that difficult to make an argument that says something like the Second Amendment should mean something else, or maybe we should pass a constitutional amendment, or we should come up with statutes that in some way won't fall afoul of the Second Amendment, but will prevent people from owning guns. What I worry about, it's a point that I make in the article, and I think it's something that in talking to many folks involved in criminal practice, it's something you see, is that there are a range of other rights, of other liberties, of other interests that are implicated by these statutes. Right. So I think maybe the best example is to think about the stop and frisk policy in New York City, where the NYPD was effectively stopping and frisking large numbers, usually of young black men, although kind of a range of people, but predominantly young black men. And the idea was there had been issues with gun violence, and there was a concern about getting guns off the street. So again, framed simply in terms of pro-gun, anti-gun, this is a measure designed to root out guns, but it implicates so many other interests, right? For generations, or at least a couple of generations, of people in New York, this meant that kind of being a person of color in New York, being someone of a certain race or age or looking a certain way meant that you were going to be subjected to kind of constant surveillance or police intrusion.
Right? And this came in for a huge amount of criticism from the center left onward left. Yet, I think people didn't really process that mass stop and frisk by the NYPD was premised on searching for guns, even though it turned up a lot more small amounts of marijuana. The premise and justification was always searching for guns. Yet even with all the criticism of the program that ultimately resulted in a federal judge ruling that it was unconstitutional, even then the mainstream critics of Stop and Frisk didn't really seem to grasp how Bloomberg in particular's anti-gun, gun control agenda was expressed most of all through Stop and Frisk.
Right. No, I think that it's a really important point that I think that the aspect gets forgotten. And, you know, I think kind of in popular discourse, it was framed in terms of the war on drugs. It was sort of folded into that conversation. And, you know, I think one of the really important lessons from a lot of this, I think not just about guns, but about the way kind of as a society, we use the criminal justice system or that kind of the government uses criminal law, is to think about these situations where criticism becomes very common, right? And take the war on drugs, take stop and frisk. And I think a danger is to frame it in sort of the least offensive terms, right? It's to say, you know, the war on drugs is a problem because marijuana is not really that bad, so we should decriminalize marijuana. Now, regardless of your feelings on marijuana or whether it should be decriminalized,
this show is decidedly pro marijuana, just as a caveat.
Right. Okay. So we're in marijuana friendly territory here, it's sort of an ahistorical claim to make the war on drugs simply about marijuana, mm-hmm. and a critique of the war on drugs that isn't able to reckon with crack, with heroin. And again, this is, I think, a huge issue as we now talk about the regulation and the criminal regulation of opioids,
yes.
Right, is the idea that the minute we start talking about something that people actually do perceive as scary, as risky, as dangerous, a lot of these critiques start to evaporate. And that's a problem if those critiques are really serious, right? If we really are concerned about the number of people being put into prison, if we're really concerned about intrusive policing, if we're really concerned about racial disparities, those need to be concerns when we talk about scary stuff as well, not just once we sort of defanged the social problem, right? Not just when we're talking about low, you know, kind of small amount possession of marijuana.
Yeah, there's this. I think one thing you're hitting on by pointing out the reluctance to apply the straightforward critique of the war on drugs to the war on guns. There are all these other problems that kind of liberal hesitancies that sort of echoes. It's the failure to apply the critique of the war on marijuana to the broader war on drugs, which really must entail an evaluation and criticism of the entire prohibitionist regime from the get-go. And if we're going to deal with mass incarceration, we have to move past this idea that prisons are just full of people who were unlucky enough or to get locked up for possessing small amounts of marijuana. I mean, frankly, that's just not who's in prison and why we have mass incarceration. We have to think of these broader regimes that criminalize such broad swaths of American life and that impose such severe sentences.
Right. And, you know, I think it's such an important point. And I know, I guess, James Foreman, who I believe has been a guest on your show,
indeed.
You know, has written this really powerful book, Locking Up Our Own. And one of his critical interventions is he looks at what happened in Washington, D.C. in a majority black city that actually had kind of it wasn't just a story of sort of some a more conservative, white, tough-on-crime population imposing its will. It was really the reality of people trying to grapple with, you know, and again, in that context, with heroin addiction, with crime, with a lot of things that are more difficult. And so I think, you know, to me, it's one of the it was one of the things that I was really drawn to, this question of guns, in terms of is the fact that if we're really serious about those critiques and if we want to do something about the system, it does us no good to pretend that that those problems aren't out there, which is why I think it is important to have these conversations, you know, in the wake of the shootings in Las Vegas, in the wake of these really horrible events that, you know, there's always the conversation about, you know, can they be politicized or not politicized? And, you know, of course, this is when we should have these conversations. I think the really important point, though, and the thing that we need to grapple with in all of this is sort of what are the trade-offs? And it's not just a question of doing something or doing nothing. It's, you know, what is that something? And it's something that, you know, Forman and others have recounted. We look back kind of at a number of crime spikes, at a number of moments where there was a lot of attention paid to drug addiction and other things, is that, you know, too often that do something response was carceral.
Yeah, something that Forman recounts in his book is that Eric Holder, who ultimately was sort of hailed in some ways, not at all, as a civil rights hero, as attorney general, was also, I believe, in the earlier mid-1990s, the first black U.S. attorney for D.C., where he distinguished himself by going after illegal gun possessions, just gun possession relentlessly.
Right. And again, you know, kind of the it's really easy to paint all of this in terms of kind of like there's a good response and there's a bad response and there's, you know, this is, people are overreacting or not reacting enough. I think, you know, the really important thing is trying to develop a language. And again, a lot of really exciting and I think important work has been coming out in the past few years, although, you know, folks have been working on these issues for of course, a long time. But trying to ask, you know, how do we deal with whether it's actually what we would call violent crime or simply, and again, you know, I personally don't think that possessory gun crimes are violent, although there is actually sort of a decent amount of both judicial and scholarly debate about that point. But, you know, a range of different crimes or a range of conduct, let's call it, that that just makes people more uncomfortable because it does seem like there's harm. And I will point to, because I think it's really significant to this, that there's long been an argument that's been popular among kind of real supporters of the drug war, that drug crime is in and of itself violent, particularly drug dealing or drug trafficking, right? And you know, Jeff Sessions has kind of endorsed this position on a number of occasions. We have a number of kind of prosecutorial organizations, and again, you know, certainly not
drug
all
dealing,
but kind of
like drug overdose homicide charges are making a comeback right now.
Right, absolutely. Which again, you know, kind of throws into stark relief the claims that what we're seeing is kind of a medical approach to opioids. But again, I think really important that what we're seeing is sort of some sense that if there is harm caused by conduct, if people suffer as a result of it, we should view that as violent. And then kind of by extension, if something is violent, it's not, it doesn't get the kind of critical treatment that we say have reserved for, and again, I'd say the war on drugs, but not really true for war on drugs that people now feel less threatened by.
Before we move on, I wanted to rewind a little to where we were talking about stop and frisk and the kind of unacknowledged justification for that, or not unacknowledged, but not like easily forgotten justification for that being the search for illegal guns, which was also accompanied, people forget, by Bloomberg, whose successful push, I believe, for a New York state law with a really severe an inflexible mandatory minimum for legal gun possession. Anyhow, that the history of this goes way deeper to Terry v. Ohio, the 1960 what Supreme Court decision? I don't recall exactly, but the Supreme Court decision that basically said it's okay for police to conduct street stop and frisks with the much lower standard below probable cause of reasonable suspicion. So this kind of very basic police practice of stop and frisk that allows police to detain you and touch you is premised on the search for guns as well. Is that right?
Right, that's correct. So Terry, which is, it's 1968. I wish that I knew that actually off the top of my head. But I'm quick with my typing fingers. So Terry, which leads to the Terry stop, as it's known, right, which is the idea that officers can do a kind of a pat down, and the justification is at least as offered by the court, something about officer safety, right? There's some idea that an officer, if not that the police officer is supposed to be, you know, searching for contraband or looking for evidence of a crime, but it's that the officer should be able to look and see if someone's armed. But I think it is worth noting that is the justification, right? Like the question is actually about identifying whether someone has a gun, which means that it is kind of baked into a significant amount of criminal procedure in the U.S., of policing in the U.S., of a lot of how things are done, is that the ubiquity of firearms in this country does lead to a lot of kind of strange and conflicting case law, right? And this is something you mentioned earlier, kind of this sort of two-tiered or double standard in terms of who actually has the right to bear arms. But it is a really fascinating question, and something that's being litigated and has been litigated is the question of what actually happens to policing and to police searches in a moment or in a legal regime in which the Supreme Court has actually recognized the legal right to bear arms, right? Because we read about so many cases where so many of the kind of the heavily publicized and really tragic police violence cases where a shooting will be deemed justified because an officer thought that someone was armed.
Philando Castile.
Exactly. Or not even the shooting cases, but simply a case where maybe an officer will stop someone because of a suspicious bulge, right? Which is something that, if you read Fourth Amendment cases, there are many such cases. It becomes a really interesting question. And again, you know, there's some folks writing about this. There are definitely some cases that have arisen where there is now a live question, right? Can a police officer actually continue to stop someone because they have a suspicious bulge? Because particularly in a state that has concealed carry laws, why is that bulge suspicious? That person might be carrying a gun, and the legislature and the court has decided that that's okay. But what it does raise the specter of, which gets to your earlier point, that I think should be kind of concerning. It should be concerning to us. Is the question of, what would then make it reasonable? Well, does that person look like the type of person who maybe shouldn't be carrying a gun concealed? And what does that mean? What are the assumptions that would be baked into that? Are there assumptions about race, about who might be a lawful or unlawful gun possessor? Which is, I think, does become one of the real peculiarities of living in a country where guns are so ubiquitous, enjoy so much sort of legal protection, but at the same time, the very presence of guns, as you say, from Terry onward, is used to justify some incredibly intrusive policing and has led to many people serving very long periods of time in prison.
It's this point where there's this really that you're underlining there, where there's this really fascinating contradiction between two of the most toxic features of American society, which is the gun culture on the one hand, and the impunity for and celebration of invasive police state tactics on the other. And they just can't really, they're ultimately sort of irreconcilable, it seems.
There's this really wonderful essay that I do just want to flag. It's not a wonderful essay. I think it's something that anyone should read who's interested in these questions. There's this essay from 1994, and I think either the New York Times or the New York Times Magazine, by James Q. Wilson, who's the kind of father of broken windows policing, is really, really big proponent of aggressive police tactics. And he has this piece, and it's called "Just Take Away Their Guns." And he may claim that if we're really serious as a society about about stopping gun violence, there's only one way to really effectively do that and really effectively regulate guns, and that's to have police do a whole bunch of really terrible things. And Wilson, given his views on policing, is kind of okay with the idea that you'll have police basically profiling and trying to figure out who might have guns illegally and just stopping them and taking them, right? It's the stop and frisk program. But I think the point that's so important that Wilson makes, he says the two of these things are based. They go hand in hand, right? If we really do want to imagine a society in which the police can come and take away people's guns, that means we have a society where there's a specific vision of policing. And I think what does make these discussions and these conversations so hard is that I think for so many folks who don't have that vision of policing, who don't actually, who when they hear about stop and frisk, they're appalled. It's so difficult because I think it's what makes possessory crime just generally as a concept so difficult is, how do you enforce possession crime? Well, either you have sort of intrusive or invasive police searches to try to ferret out what's being possessed, or it sort of ceases to have the same purpose preventatively because what it stands as is an extra punishment tacked on at the end, right? If police can't find the weapon in advance, all it means is, there's an extra charge dropped on at the end. Once someone is arrested for committing some other crime, then, by the way, it turned out that they also had an illegal gun, which again raises the question of what those laws are doing. If we believe in deterrence, if we think that people are going to be deterred from having guns illegally because they think if they do something else bad, or if police stop them, then they're going to be subject to again potentially lengthy prison sentence. Then maybe it is an appealing model or it's okay. But I think it's important to remember that what we're talking about then still is resting on kind of this deterrence ideal. And from a preventative standpoint, it is still really tough to know, again, unless we're dealing with policing that's the sort that you describe or that, as I say, kind of Wilson is more supportive of.
Maybe Wilson, unlike many of his conservative colleagues, is not a sort of gun rights absolutist, but for many on the right, libertarians accepted, they simultaneously celebrate unfettered police power and also this sort of Second Amendment armed white vigilantism, that has deep roots in American settler colonialism. And ultimately they simultaneously sort of bolster each other ideologically, but also have this deep contradiction of sort of like, these are the people who embrace American militarism and police power domestically and abroad so fervently, which entails some notion of the state having a monopoly on violence, but then simultaneously kind of white vigilante gun possession also being unfettered, which has kind of this militia vibe to it. It becomes more anti-statist when it becomes actually Bundy out in Oregon with his militia. But when it's not that explicit militia iteration, there's kind of this unresolved relationship between the two ideologically, it seems to me.
Yeah, no, and I think kind of two points on that. One, I think this is actually what makes some of Radley Balko's work so fascinating, right? Who's taken kind of maybe more of a libertarian stance on a range of issues, but has come out as incredibly critical of kind of what he describes as the rise of the warrior cop, but of kind of militarized policing, but who I think is sort of trying to make sense of some of these things or at least articulate a position. And again, I know, there are other folks doing this who are, maybe might take a more libertarian stand on a number of issues and put policing in that frame. But I think, kind of to your mention of the Bundy situation, right? I think there's actually something really telling there as well. And I think this is a struggle for folks on the left. It's a struggle for folks on the right, which is to think about kind of the comfort that any of us has with policing or the criminal justice system when it's dealing with, again, people, I won't just say people we disagree with, because that's not, that's, that's not accurate and that doesn't go far enough. I think it's when we're dealing with people who we think are dangerous.
And who we think merit punishment. Yeah, that's when carceral liberalism rears its head. That's why it's so hard to have discussions about sex offenders being one of the fastest growing portions of the prison population, and why it was so disturbing to see all of these liberals complaining that the FBI basically wasn't like massacring the Bundy occupiers, however repulsive their views might be and they might be personally.
Right. And I think it raises a few questions, again, kind of for all of us as we think about sort of our own personal reactions to these things. I mean, I think one is that, like, all of this is about trade-offs. And right, I mean, you know, it may be, and it's true with the gun possession statutes, right? It's not at all implausible to me. And I think it's, that you could know the realities of stop and frisk. You could look at the somewhat limited data that we have of kind of who gets charged under different statutes. And we could see that, it turns out that it seems like, for example, at least in certain jurisdictions, black defendants face, for example, felon in possession sentence enhancements more often than their white counterparts. We could look at things like that, but that you might, as someone looking at these issues, still decide that the benefits of such a law, that the potential for reducing gun violence outweighs those costs. And again, that's a personal decision that'll be rooted in kind of your own worldview and again, belief on which dangers were greater than the other. And I think that's true with all of these kinds of conversations. I think what worries me always is the sense that in some of these conversations, the harm is treated as so bad or so scary or so indefensible that we don't ask those same questions, right? That we don't ask those questions of, who's going to be arrested? Who's going to be prosecuted? Who's going to be put in prison? What does prison look like? What are these, again, what are the costs of that carceral turn? And again, it may be that knowing all of those costs, many folks would still, wholeheartedly embrace the carceral turn. But I think there should be, and there needs to be, a reckoning with what those costs are. And just kind of one more thing kind of on the Bundy point. There's writing about this, and it's a point that folks have made, and I think it's an important one, is in a lot of these situations where we witness kind of unequal treatment, it's a question of leveling up or leveling down. I will flag a friend of mine and colleague of mine, Kate Levine, who's a professor at St. John's, has some really fascinating work on what happens in the prosecution of police in force cases. And her claim, which I think is a really fascinating and provocative one, is that a lot of folks criticize all of the procedural protections that police get when they're prosecuted. But maybe the takeaway from that shouldn't be it's bad that police get all those procedural protections. Maybe the takeaway should be, your average defendant should also get, a grand jury or have the same type, a grand jury looking at evidence in the same way, or have the same type of procedural protections. Again, agree or disagree, I think the point is, I think it's very tempting in some situations when we look around, we say, there are so many people from marginalized communities, there's so many poor people, there's so many people of color, so many queer people who don't have the same benefits in a range of areas, and they get treated poorly by the system. And then we hear of the case where, the affluent white defendant does something and gets a comparatively lighter sentence. I think it's important to remember that when we start hitting on the lightness of that sentence, it becomes a move that sort of reifies or reinforces the notion that some kind of greater sentence is justified, rather than saying, why is it that these people are being treated differently? Why isn't it that the poor defendant of color doesn't get some of these same benefits?
I could not agree more. The idea that the demand should be for the carceral state to treat everyone just as shittily only feeds its power and legitimates it in the criminal justice system as the solver of all problems in society. And there's nothing more dangerous than that very basic idea that governs American political culture. I want to talk about what maybe could be done, because the debate feels so constrained, where we have this very truncated debate, very truncated media coverage, where there's a sort of carceral liberal position on the one hand and a conservative guns for everyone position on the other. And this was really dramatically demonstrated last year when Democrats staged that sit-in, demanding that people be on the these enormous dragnet terrorism watch lists, which includes the no-fly list, which have no basis in people actually having ties to terrorism and have no due process rights. You know, you have Democrats sitting in demanding that, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people on these lists be barred from having guns. And it's like totally surreal. But I also don't want, I hate that we have guns everywhere in this country. And I don't think much of the NRA, and I don't think also very much of the left-wing arguments that, you know, we need to hoard guns to fight the state. Is there a different position that both might disarm American society, but that doesn't feed mass incarceration?
So that, of course, is the I'd say the million-dollar question, but I think my scale is off. It's the huge question here. There definitely are regulatory options that I think would not feed the carceral state, and I think might be steps in the direction that you're describing. Again, though, this is where I started out with kind of how we've gotten where we've gotten, is that they're politically very, very difficult. They're very difficult moves to make, right? So a shift to focusing on manufacture and sale, and I think primarily on manufacture, wouldn't disarm the population, and it certainly wouldn't do anything about the I guess what the last estimate I've read is over 300 million guns in the country. but what it would do is reduce the continuous flow of guns. It potentially would reduce the manufacture of weapons that people think are particularly dangerous or things along those lines. Again, the issue there becomes one of that is a place where I think the interest group politics make it very hard. But I do think there's a story where we said that kind of folks who were really concerned about gun control were truly prioritizing that and weren't willing to make some of these compromises on criminal issues. Maybe that would help. Again, though, I know that the political ground there is deeply fraught. So I think that would be one thing. I mean, the actual what to do about the guns that are on the ground, though, is the really difficult piece of this. Because again, you know, unless we do want to endorse the James Wilson style, you know, just take away their guns, unless we are comfortable with the possessory offenses, there are a lot of guns that are out there. There have been buyback programs in many jurisdictions that have kind of met with varying degrees of success. I think kind of if you're someone who wants to reduce the number of guns, that's certainly something to think about. Although again, I think we have at least some data and reason to think that a lot of folks who own guns will own many guns and are probably not people who are going to be interested in the buyback programs, right? In some ways,
to put it mildly.
Yes, to put it mildly. I mean, in some sense, I think, you know, the buyback programs are often geared more toward maybe an unlicensed handgun or something like that, a gun that, you know, at some point has wound up in someone's house that at some point they maybe purchased unlawfully, or maybe they purchased lawfully, but things have lapsed. That'd be one option. But again, I think we're thinking about this kind of from a market perspective. It would be thinking about trying to reduce the actual new guns coming into the market. So that would be part of it. We haven't talked at all about the very controversial 2005 law, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which came up significantly in the last election in the Democratic primary, which is the act that that basically shields gun manufacturers and gun sellers from tort liability, from civil liability in a range of contexts. People feel very differently about that, not just along predictable kind of pro-gun, anti-gun terms. There are a lot of different sort of positions there. It's true in the world of legal scholars for folks who study the tort system. But you know, one other way of thinking about this would be kind of from a tort or civil liability perspective, to the extent Congress were willing or able to either repeal or amend that statute, that you can imagine a world in which maybe manufacturers or sellers would face liability in more contexts, which might again kind of add to the reduction in new guns on the market, or in some way kind of regulate the market even more strictly. But really, to be honest, and I think this is what makes it so hard, and it is one reason that people wind up with the criminal alternatives, there's not a great way other than kind of changing culture and sort of a range of those really, really hard conversations to have that go beyond guns, of actually doing something about the fact that there are just so many guns.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a critical point. The cat is out of the bag. The cat is heavily armed and totally has his brain fucked up by a toxic, violent gun culture that we live in. And I think there's something very tempting to many liberals to kind of look for these technocratic solutions when American violence and gun culture are so deeply intertwined with so many other problems in this country, going back to slavery and the maintenance of white supremacy, thereafter American militarism and mass incarceration, all of those things. And there's no silver bullet.
Yeah. Right. No, and I think, you know, I think in fairness, it's one of the challenges. Again, you know, I'd mentioned before, I think one of the problems with framing everything in terms of the Second Amendment is that we then lose out on so many of these other important conversations that need to be had. And I think one issue in the gun conversations is understanding how deeply entrenched guns are in different quarters of society for different reasons, right? There's some really fascinating work done on kind of the social meaning of guns, which is, you know, is different in different places and for different people, and that trying to figure out how to address gun violence. Again, it's something that so many people have been working on for so long and have been working so hard on, that it is also the appeal of a one-size-fits-all solution is not, I think, you know, it's just not something that will work, right? The way to address kind of the terrible problem of suicide by gun in this country is probably a different conversation than the conversation about how to reduce, for example, kind of, let's say, homicides among you know, young men of a certain age, right? Like these are they may be related conversations, and there's the important common denominator, maybe not denominator, the important common link of guns. But again, because of their ubiquity, because of their place in society, there's something that requires, I think, so many different interventions in so many different places, which, yeah, it makes, unfortunately, in society, so often the closest we come to one-size-fits-all answers is criminal law.
On that, I'm going to let you go. Ben Levin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan. My pleasure.
Ben Levin is a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School who teaches and writes about criminal law and procedure. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once confided in the privacy of his therapist's office, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our Postmaster General is Christian Tyler. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio. And please find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, leave us a review. And please tell your friends about the show. They might like it. Then more people are listening to the show. And then we're one small step closer to fully automated luxury communism. Also, last but not least, before we get to that point of fully automated luxury communism, we need your support on patreon.com. Even a little bit helps a lot.